For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, last week we were going over the stark contrast between American, typical American people and the poor, the rich and the poor. The rich, that's us, and the poor. And there's something very jarring about this contrast. Our world, it's shimmering, clean, happy, partying. You know, our biggest problem is our fat, because we can't stop eating. And then the poor are living in filth and, grinding labor, partying and stuff would be the last thing that they would be concerned about. And they're just worried about survival and barely doing that. Jesus had quite a bit to say about this. Here's an interesting story that I think in Luke chapter 10, I think this could go a long way toward helping us understand his point of view. In this story, an expert in the law came up to question Christ in public, and he asked him, what are the most important laws that we're supposed to follow from the Bible? And Jesus said, well, what do you think? And so we read, Jesus says, the greatest laws are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. Well, the expert in the law wanted to justify himself. He asked Jesus, yeah, but who is my neighbor? That's a reference to the classic discussion in rabbinic literature that survived to us, where the rabbis taught that when it says you should love your neighbor as yourself, a neighbor is somebody who acts neighborly. So they had diluted this law to the point where you only have to love people that are acting like you think they should act. Jesus tells a story. In reply, he said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. It's interesting that he picks out a priest and a Levite. You know, it's possible that these guys may have been on their way up to Jerusalem to do religious service. And in the Mosaic law, if a priest or a Levite touches something dead, then they are disqualified from doing religious service for a period of time, because it was kind of a symbolic teaching about the connection between death and sin. And so that was considered ritually unclean if you touched a dead thing, dead person, dead animal, anything like that. So it may be that this could have played in. Isn't that ironic that they're going to serve God at the temple, and yet here is real service that's needed, and they pass by on the other side? Well, I don't know whether I'm reading too much into it there or not. But these are the villains in this story, the priest and the Levite. And according to Jesus, the sin of which these guys are guilty is mainly the sin of doing nothing. The same sin that the judge convicted people in, we were reading from Matthew 25 last week, I was hungry and you didn't feed me. And Jesus applied that to the least of these, my brethren. They weren't the ones that beat him. They weren't the ones that robbed him. They didn't put him in this condition, but they saw him in that condition. And for all we know, their heart may have gone out. You know, walking by, oh man, crime on this road's awful. Hate to see that kind of stuff, you know. Poor sucker. You know, I mean, for all we know, they felt bad for the guy, but they did nothing. And that's not good enough. That's not loving your neighbor. Well, we read in 33 that a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was. And when he saw him, he took pity on him. Interesting that he picks a Samaritan for this role, seeing as how Jews and Samaritans really didn't get along. That was one of the real racial barriers in that culture. You read in John 4, the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. They just wouldn't talk to them or deal with them at all. A lot of hostility between Samaritans and Jews. Here comes a Samaritan walking up. Actually, he's riding a donkey, we'll find out. He took pity on him, and he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, a typical medicinal treatment for wounds in that day. Then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn and took care of him. So the first thing that we notice about the Samaritan is he saw this guy, he's naked, he's covered in blood, streaked in blood and filth, bruised, cut, and he had compassion on him. Now some of your translations read he had compassion or he felt pity. The basic response of the heart that should be there towards people who are suffering, that we feel sorry for them, that we are moved with compassion. We read that he went to him. And so it wasn't that the man came to the Samaritan and said, please help me. Instead, it was the Samaritan who took it upon himself to go out and to initiate love toward this man. And that's a key part of biblical love, as we learn about it in the Bible, is not waiting until somebody's up in your face pleading for something, but discerning need and going out and taking the initiative, just like God took the initiative with us, the same way. We're supposed to discover need and go forward to try to meet it. We read that he bandaged his wounds. So he met his immediate needs. Wouldn't it have been foolish if he had sat down next to the guy and opened a Bible to preach him a sermon at this point? That's not what he needs right now. That part could come later. What he needs right now is to have his wounds bandaged. And so immediate need has to be met on an emergency basis. Then we read, he put the man on his own donkey. In other words, he did for the man what he couldn't do for himself. He was half dead. He had to heave him up onto the donkey. And so we'll find that many in this world are unable to change their plight on their own. We have to do for them what they're not able to do for themselves. We also see that there didn't just happen to be a donkey there. This was the Samaritan's own donkey. And the reason he had a donkey is that he was riding the donkey up this very steep road from Jericho up into Jerusalem. And so he sacrifices his right to ride on his own donkey and walks the rest of the way with this man draped over his donkey. And so there is sacrifice. There is the giving up of what is rightfully mine, what I can claim to be mine. I give that up for the sake of the suffering person. 1 John 3:16 says, we know love by this, that he, Jesus, laid down his life for us. And so we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. We're willing to let Jesus lay down his life for us. That doesn't bother us. So then, but we're not willing to lay our lives down. That's a problem. He says that whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Something that happens way too often. Closing our heart against the poor. The next day, we read, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. These would be 2 denarii, each a day's wage. So, you know, maybe a couple $100 by today's standards. And he said to the innkeeper, look after him. And he said, when I return, I'll reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. And so in both of these the giving the money to the innkeeper, and also offering, I'll cover any other additional expenses, he's meeting the longer-term needs. So this is not just emergency relief. And it points to a key quality of love, that we're not just trying to do something nice for somebody, but that we're actually trying to change lives, and that we're prepared to sacrifice in order to see that happen. That's the way of Jesus. So, he comes back to the dude he was talking to. He says, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. And Jesus told him, go and do likewise. And that statement is directly pointed at you and me here tonight. Go and do likewise. So we have our instructions. Let's think tonight. I want to get into the question of practical ideas for how we can make a difference with the poor. And we're going to start this week by thinking about the poor right here, near at hand, in our own land. We saw last week the complicating factors that caring for the poor isn't as easy as some people think. If we just give money or food to people, it creates dependency. It actually perpetuates and deepens poverty. It's not helpful. Yes, on an emergency basis, a handout, yes. But if you just keep doing that, you're really not helping people. You're not teaching them the things they need to know in order to sustain their lives and escape the grind of poverty after you're out of the picture. And instead, you've taught them to beg and to depend. There's the history of Western intervention, which has been very negative, frankly, in most lands. Colonialism, conquest, commercial self-serving at the expense of indigenous populations, and a complete lack of interest in them and their culture and lives. Then, too, a lot of the underlying causes for poverty are spiritual, not just physical. There are physical causes. There are institutional reasons why people are poor, but there are also spiritual reasons. And so it's not simply enough to try to elevate somebody's physical standing in life and their personal wealth unless there's a change in the heart. It will all dissipate in a minute. We talked about a plan, just rolled this out briefly last week, that we need a plan for helping the poor that includes several caveats. We want to develop impact that is spiritual, that includes that spiritual part and brings the love of Christ to people, that is long-term, like the Good Samaritan, not just immediate relief, but which makes a permanent difference in people's lives, so that families and communities are elevated in a lasting way. Whether we're there with them or we go away, they continue to do well. That's holistic, a term that means that we don't just focus on one aspect of life, but that we try to cover the entire scope of human need. That also is contextualized so that we're not bringing help in a way that is trying to get people to move out of their culture into our culture, but which is sensitive to the cultural setting they're in and adapts what we give in such a way that it's fitting and works within their culture. Well, when we, and finally, the most important, one of the most important qualifications on this help is that it needs to be done in such a way that it fosters independence in the people we give to. And so when we add these caveats to the desire to help the poor, we've just made the job at least 10 times more difficult than it was before. At least. Maybe 100 times more difficult than simply handing out some money or food to people in need. What are these spiritual issues in poverty? We'll speak some tonight about issues in this country, but next week we have some issues in other countries as well. when we look at world poverty, you see that most of the heavy poverty in the world is in the southern hemisphere, much worse off than the north. And especially the continent of Africa is easily the worst when it comes to poverty. That's interesting. Why is Africa so much worse than other countries? We wonder that. There's a lot of reasons, actually. One of the key reasons is war. Also, governmental corruption and oppression of people makes it so that even people who are working hard and, you know, trying to do right by their families and so forth will have that wealth sucked away. And also, anyone who tries to come in and help will have their help sucked away by corrupt leaders. In many areas of Africa today, we cannot even get in to help people for the simple reason that it's too dangerous to go in there. Bullets are flying, people are being slaughtered into thousands. And so these areas are just people, we have to wait until the violence dies down. Colonialism was a key cause of poverty in Africa. The colonial powers came to exploit. They came for profit, not to help Africans in any way, shape, or form. And the legacy of colonialism, you know, the colonialists left, usually after bloody uprisings. They didn't leave stable governments in their wake. They didn't leave any infrastructure in their wake. And as a result, chaos broke out. The earlier tribal system had been replaced by modern conditions, but no corresponding move to a suitable modern solution was given. In America, we see the same principle. We have about 13% of Americans are considered poor by the U.S. government, which is defined currently as a family of four living on less than $22,000 per year. Yeah, that would be pretty tight. $22,000 for four people? It's about, what, five, less than six, 5,000? And some each, that's not much. And this 13% varies between 12 and 14% in most years. This chart, which is older, I didn't get to update it. I was having trouble getting data on this. Percent income change from 79 to 94. Broken up in quintiles, where the population in the U.S. is broken up into five segments. And you see the top 20%, their income increased by 24% during that period. The lowest quintile decreased in real buying power. This is all corrected for inflation. The closest charts I could find today on this, coming up here till 2003, just shows that since the early 90s, this trend has simply gotten worse. There's been no increase. There's been some decrease in the earning of the bottom two quintiles, and the top ones are soaring upward further still. Here we have income distribution by decile in selected OECD countries. So they've cut it into 10 pieces here. And we find the U.S. right here, and you can see by the length of the bar that the U.S. has the widest income disparity of any of these countries, these developed countries. Here's a chart showing the gain from 67 to 2003, again, between the 95th percentile, the median, the 20th percentile, and you see that people down in the 20th percentile, the lower class in America, their income has hardly changed between 67 and 2003, whereas the wealthy, their income has soared during that period. Here's the same thing on a different chart, using quintiles again, from 79 to 2005, so this is more current. And we see this staggering inequity where the poor in America are staying poor, even getting poorer, whereas the wealthy are just soaring forward in increasing wealth. The top 1%, look at their jump in wealth. Hunger in a Global Economy, they have an article there saying how the United States has the highest inequality in the industrial world because of the income gap between well-educated professionals and workers with limited education. Over the past 20 to 30 years, Americans have also experienced the greatest increase in income equality among inequality among rich nations. The more detailed the data we can use to observe this change, the more skewed the change appears to be. The majority of large gains are indeed at the top of the distribution, says economist Timothy Smealy. Percent of households below poverty line by type of household. So at the bottom are all households, and this year it was, that was a couple of years back, it was 14% at that point. It's gone down to 13, probably go back up as we speak with the recession in progress. General families, only 10%. Families with children, 14%. Look at the top one, female-headed families with children, 41%. Oh man, so that looks like that is a significant factor in poverty in the U.S., doesn't it? Single mothers raising children are the poorest. And why are they single mothers? Usually because of divorce or because of teenage illegitimacy. Those are the most common reasons. Here's another observation. African Americans are more than twice as likely to be poor than whites in America. So there's a racial aspect to this as well. And you can also probably connect those two dots because illegitimacy and single parent homes are rampant in the inner city today. Here are types of households, single-parent families compared to married families. This is from a different source. This includes those single-parent with fathers. When we do it single-parent with mothers, female-headed families, it jumps up to 6 times more likely to be poor than intact families. We see that the same thing is true in black community. More of intact families of blacks are poor than of intact families of white, 9.9%. But still way more, 39%, near 40% of single parent households are below the poverty line. This chart compares birth rates for teenagers, that is teenagers having kids, in a number of different countries. And we see that the U.S. at the top by far is the worst country in the developed world when it comes to teenagers having kids. It's rampant in this culture. That number, this is from 95, UN Demographic Yearbook. And the last information I got on this is that that teenage birth rate in America has declined a little bit since this chart in the past few years, so that's maybe a good sign. Factors in unmarried births. Why are girls, young girls, having children and they're not married? And why is this so rampant in our culture? Seidel argues that factors contributing to teen pregnancy and childbirth include inadequate sex education, especially about contraception and family planning. Yeah, I wonder about that. You know, when I grew up, I was a teenager back in the 60s. You couldn't even get a condom. You had to be 21 to buy one. Not that I was out necessarily shopping for them all the time, but that probably my friends were. You sure couldn't get them from your school, I'll tell you that. frankly, today we're in an ocean of condoms. You know, they're being thrown at us from every direction. And yet the teenage illegitimacy has soared during these past few decades. Aren't we really looking here at a spiritual issue? Why wouldn't you fornicate? Why not hit the sheets and maybe get pregnant? Isn't that really a moral, spiritual question? It is for me. That's the only reason I've ever had for not doing it. It has to do with the will of God and learning that sexual immorality is just exploitation of another person, using someone else's body to gratify yourself. That's why we as Christians don't believe in it. We believe in that sexuality belongs in the context where two people have decided to commit their lives together. And so where you see groups of people meeting God, adopting His point of view, you'll see teenage pregnancy drop to virtually nothing. Yeah, a lot of causes of poverty are spiritual. Percentage of teen births that occurred outside of marriage, look at how it's been rising. And this too, they say, has moderated just in the past decade or so. Here's another factor, percent in poverty in the U.S. by education level. So those with less than a high school degree, very high level of poverty, a quarter of them are going to end up below the poverty line, them and their families with them. High school grads, only 12%. If you've had some college, maybe an associate's degree, that goes down to 8%. And people with bachelor's degree, it's relatively rare. Only one person in 40 would be poor in that group. So education is obviously a huge issue here as well. And any effort to minister to the inner city, to the urban poor in the U.S. had better have something to do with educational help. Because the large city school districts, including our district, have betrayed the poor person. The education that you can get in these school systems is pitiful. And people come out after 12 years of school functionally illiterate. How well is that person going to do then in a modernistic society when they can basically not really read? And all the money has to do with technology and being educated. That's a pretty hopeless situation. And whose fault is it if they got up to teenage years and they've been in school that long and didn't learn how to read? It's hard to blame the kid. The families have something to do with it. The lack of nurture, you wouldn't believe how difficult it is to educate inner city kids. They come into preschool age and kindergarten age missing so many of the nurturant features that we take for granted. The fact that that people read to them when they were little kids. That they already have, a lot of them come in already able to read. I got two grandkids that could read before they went to school. You won't find any of that in the inner city. These people are mentally starved. They've been ignored and left on their own for huge tracts of time. Mom is preoccupied. She's busy trying to earn a living. She's gone. Dad, no one knows what happened to him. And it's a desperate situation. And so these kids have a difficult time learning. It takes a lot of extra nurture and care to educate inner city kids. So what shall we do? Basically, we're arguing that we should all band together and get a coordinated cross-cultural effort to serve the poor. We are going to have to leave our culture and enter into cultures that are different than ours. Whether in this country, you go into the inner city, it's a different culture than what we have up here on the university campus. And if you go to other lands, the difference is even going to be more extreme. And so we're called to get out of our comfort zone and to get into theirs. People will learn next week that go into world ministry, spend the first usually 5 years of solid work and suffering, doing nothing, little really, besides learning the language and culture of the people they're going to serve for the next 15 years. We need to do service, we need to serve people in the context of long-term love relationships, the changing power of the love of God. That's what people need. And here is where governmental programs, I think, will never succeed. They can hand out cheese and buy them housing. You know, America recently went through a big round of just blowing up all these urban renewal projects, where the theory was, if we get people to live in a nice condo-like building, you know, then they'll change their behavior. Typical superficial external answer to the problem that's so typical of the world. That's the perspective of the world. We'll just turn the knobs on the external and change the environment, and then because they feel that people are like programmed beings, that will change them. Completely omitting the personal and spiritual dimensions of this. We can't do that. We have to be willing to go in and actually befriend these people, to love them with the love of Christ, and in that context, to show them how they can escape poverty. That's going to cost. There comes the sacrifice now. This is the missing element in most church-related charities today in the U.S., is that nobody wants to go and make friends with the poor. We need to do better than that. Our service needs to come in the name of Christ and by His power. To think that this is just a humanistic endeavor is wrong and will fail. Christ changes lives. And we as Christians know that. We've had our own lives changed, and we know that Jesus has the power to change lives. And not just temporarily either, but permanently from the inside out. And so when we bring help, not that we only help Christians, that we help all poor people, but that we make it clear that we are Christians and that this is why we're doing what we're doing. And that we must build and maintain our base of operations, like what we're sitting in right here. It'd be foolish just to say, let's throw down everything and just run off to serve the poor. We shouldn't waste another dollar on building the base of the fellowship here. Well, that would be a real short-sighted and frankly ignorant position to take. You know, if we hadn't reached people here in the thousands in the fellowship, none of this ministry would be going on. It's essential that we continue that work at the same time that we reach out to the poor. Both things have to happen, and they have to run together, or else you're just sawing off the limb that you're sitting on. I'm going to go over briefly what we've done so far, because this story isn't over. Okay, there are a lot of new ideas. There's going to be many different things happening in the future, but here's where we've come so far. We have set up one of our six divisions in our church. It's called the Missions Division, and it largely deals with this issue of ministry to the poor. All of the people in our Missions Division work with the poor. There are 80.1 full-time equivalent staff. Half of those are indigenous, that is, in other countries, people that we have hired there to work with us in this project. So about 40 here in town. Full-time equivalent, because there are really more people in that working for us, but some of them are part-time, so this is pooling them all together into the equivalent of full-timers. 16.3 of those equivalents are in domestic ministry, which we're going to discuss tonight. 61 of them are in world ministry. And we have 3 full-time equivalents working here at the church to oversee this whole thing. It's a pretty vast effort. We also experience significant costs in our infrastructure and operations. We have facilities and costs associated with just the ability to run these ministries cost money, and that's found that part comes in from a different division. Also, the equipping budget is hit by our efforts to offer classes and training to poor people. This is the how much we spend on missions as of 2008, about $2.1 million. Our total budget in this church is about 5.6 million. So 2.1 of that goes into this missions project through the various things that are itemized there. That's about 33%, a third of our spending goes into missions. We started out back in 1987. Up until that time, we really hadn't, there were people that were trying to do ad hoc things to help the poor, but we were mainly preoccupied with our own rapid growth in the church to such an extent. And I think we also naively thought that house churches would spread into poor neighborhoods spontaneously and that we would see a ministry of the poor develop that way. We began to realize in the mid-80s it wasn't going to happen, that birds of a feather stick together, that all of our home churches seem to be developing, from campus northward and east and west, but not moving into the inner city. And we realized we're going to have to take this in hand and do something intentional, purposeful here. The first thing we did was devote $50,000 for that year to open up an inner city ministry in Columbus. We selected an area to focus on, about 1 square mile in South Linden. The reason for doing this is that when you deal with poverty, there is so much of it and the need is so vast that you can just spend money endlessly and it just disappears into this shoreless ocean of need. And you never really know whether anything's happening or not. And so by describing a physical limit that we would focus our efforts, and it doesn't mean we don't give to anything else, but this is where most of our effort goes. On the council, John Perkins and other black leaders, they urged us to partner with an African-American church, which we did. We found Rhema Christian Fellowship, a righteous, God-fearing church here in town, all African-American church, and they agreed to join us and help. They went in with us, got us the introductions with people. One of our staffers today, James Brown, the one of our leaders of this ministry, was a member at Rhema Christian at the time. We charged the guy that we hired to lead this and the others that were going with them to begin investing in the lives of people in that neighborhood with a focus and emphasis on children. The reason for this is that we're dealing with an area here that is dominated by gang life. This is crack central, particularly back in the 80s. And what we find is that when you deal with adults in this area, the majority of them have substance abuse issues, or they're alcoholic, they're drug addicts, they're absentee. It's a very difficult proposition. Even teenagers have already been claimed by gang culture. To get outside of the reaches of gang culture, you have to get down very young to the preschool age and to invest there and then to work with these kids all the way up and give them an alternative to joining in with the gangs and that whole culture that has been so glamorized, in our day through rap and hip-hop. Everybody's, talking about gangsta this and that. And really what this is a nightmare for the people that have to live there and have their lives taken over by it. We charged our people with seeking permanent social, spiritual, and community improvement for that entire area of town. And we were prepared we told them this is a 25-year project. So your budget the first year is $50,000, and we'll increase it as we're able. The first thing we did was start a Bible study in Windsor Terrace. I was there. And people were responsive. James Brown was very helpful because he had been a gang leader himself in that neighborhood and was respected. He was a killer, a guy, a three-time loser in the state pen, convicted for armed robbery multiple times. And so he was a tough guy, you know, big, huge, tough dude. And I think he was our protector there, too, because, you know, there was a lot of suspicion. I think there's always suspicion in these neighborhoods when you see a lot of white people showing up. You know, what they're doing there, they don't belong. And so I think that was a very important role. This Bible study began to take off, and it was for kids and also working with their families. Within a matter of years, that group in Windsor Terrace as a government housing project there had grown to 200 kids in the 90s. Unfortunately, it's declined since then. The key was to begin building the relationships. And so to that end, we brought in several other threads. One of the big ones was to begin an after-school program. Kids in these neighborhoods have to go to school, but when they get out, it's going to be 3, 4, 5 hours before mom comes home, if she even does. And all of that time, they're on the street, where a lot of bad stuff happens. They're certainly not going to be doing their homework. And so an after-school program, we bought 3 crack houses there that were abandoned houses, fixed them up, and began to have this thing where we told kids at the Bible study they could come out there and their parents. And so they would be with us from the time they got out of school until after dinner time when they went home. During that period, we would feed them, give them milk and treats, and also work with them on their homework, trying to make friends, teaching them also about the things of God. And the number of kids that have gone through this system numbers in the hundreds today. We began, along with that, a tutoring program because it was quickly apparent that an after-school program was not enough, that more help was needed. And so hundreds, eventually thousands of Xenos people went and volunteered to meet with an inner city kid every week and to try to help them with things they didn't understand that they were being taught. So we focused on, and these then became friendships, many of them going on for a decade and 2 decades, where a North End adult would be meeting with a kid. The parents loved it. The parents there, you know, no one had ever shown any interest in their kids. They were just delighted that somebody was trying to help, trying to get in with them. And a lot of these friendships became pretty solid. There was an emergency relief ministry where we would meet people's emergency needs. And this is the short-term needs that we're focusing on here. One of the key reasons for having that was to meet people and to begin to form friendships where they would trust us and work with us and let us help them to overcome the barriers of. And so a lot of times doing good for somebody, just helping somebody, is the first step. And then maybe they'll listen to what you have to say later. Kids on Track was another program we started, summer job training program for kids that have never held a job. You know, here they are, 15, 16 years old, have never worked at anything in their lives. They have no concept of showing up on time at work, of not cussing out the boss or fighting with people or stealing. And so it's a training process, and that's been successful as well. In the 90s, the entire leadership core of Urban Concern, mostly white families, decided to move into Southern Linden, down to 12th Avenue, over by Cleveland and 12th, a very tough neighborhood. It was a scary move when you consider they had kids. Every night they would be woken by a gunfire in the summer. There were always SWAT teams surrounding houses nearby in the neighborhoods because the deal had gone bad and so forth. And they lived there among them. They just simply felt like, you know, we can't from outside tell them, you should do this in your situation, but we're not in that situation. And so in the spirit of the Good Samaritan, they went to them and lived there and have lived there ever since. Finally, in the after 2000, we were still struggling to see lasting results in this ministry, and the people that worked in it said that even with the after-school program, the tutoring, the Kids on Track, and the other things, we also had a housing project going where we would buy old houses for a pittance and fix them up nice for people to live in. And then there was a homeowners club we started where we partnered with a bank here in town. We had to call the program off. We had to disband it because our partner, the bank, showed up with their executives to have their picture taken for this awesome ministry that was starting to loan money to the poor, which they're mandated by the government to loan a certain amount of money to the poor. They wouldn't loan it. When we get the house ready and we had the family ready to move in, they simply would not loan the money. Well, of course, their credit was crappy. We knew that. Hardly anyone in the inner city has good credit. You know, they haven't been paying their bills and stuff. And so the bank betrayed us and them, and we had to give up that project. Anyway, it finally came down to the fact that we still don't have enough investment, enough time with these kids. And so we decided to start an actual school. Harambee Christian School launched around 2000, so that we would now have them all day in school and the after-school program as well. So that we're investing in these kids now from 7:30 in the morning till 7:30 at night. And we really took things up to a new level. An entire staff of teachers in that school, all working at a fraction of what they would earn as teachers in the city school. The budget for Urban Concern has grown from that first $50,000 up to very high levels. The two high bars you see there are the past 3 years we got away from using our bought-up buildings for the school and decided to build a building that was more suitable. And so $3 million was sunk into that. That's why those two bars are so high. The other decline that you see there back in around 2000 was the loss of the low-income housing project and the loss of staff. We lost a couple of staffers, but now it's back up to about $1.2 million each year. So it's a costly ministry. Urban Concern's a wonderful work. So when we think about the big picture, I'm calling on you all tonight to think about joining up with us. You know, some people might sit here and think, well, I don't know, this sounds like a sales pitch. Yeah. I'm here to recruit. I'll admit that. No problem with that. And to join in with us in a great work of God, of care, of compassion, of love. Begin with your personal relationship with God. We read in 2 Corinthians 8, Paul says, the Macedonians who were poor themselves were great givers, and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity, he says, because they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will. This is where it starts. You know, simply being a do-gooder leads to nothing but self-righteousness. To really give that self-giving love of Christ, the first thing you have to do is start your own personal relationship with him. And that's inviting Jesus into your life, having his death apply to your sins. And, you know, think about that. A relationship with God himself. Yes, it's possible. God's eager to know people and to rescue them. But he's not going to force it on us. We have to open the door. Jesus said to as many as open the door, when I knock, I will come in. You should think about that tonight. Secondly, we have to allow the plight of the poor to hurt us. What was the word he used? To harden our heart, to stiffen our heart against the poor. That's what's all too easy to do, is we just don't want to look at that And we don't want to be hurt by it. We have to let ourselves be hurt. We need to pray that God will lead each of us into a powerful giving ministry. Now, starting now, and right on into the future, especially when the big bucks start rolling in after graduation, we are obligated to share our wealth with the poor. And that is taught in the Bible. So if you're a Bible believer here, you know that this is something that we are obligated to do. Giving to Xenos is one of the best ways. You can get to other things as well. But we know where our dollars are going. We know what that is happening with them, and it's not being filtered off. And that's why we have the open book policy, where anyone can look at our accounting and study where every dollar in this church goes, because we believe in transparency and accountability when it comes to handling people's gifts to the Lord's work. There's also a chance to get involved in service ministry now, that a lot of college people have already come down and volunteered in the after-school program. College players are, college students are big players down there. But we also have opportunities even closer at hand. And a group here in the college ministry has taken an interest recently in forging links with some area groups that are already doing service work. We have some fairly poor people living right around here. And our ministry houses are not known as being centers of benevolence and care, but really as being kind of houses that are into their own thing and don't care about what's going on around. I got that from a community leader down here who said that everyone knows about Xenos ministry houses, but they just feel like they, you know, are having fun, but they're just doing their own thing. They're not involved. I don't think that's good. I don't think, you know, this is part of our testimony. What would it mean if a church of 5,000 people, affluent people, didn't have something like that? That'd be pretty pitiful. And so, too, we have a testimony to consider here on campus, that we should be known as the kind of people who care, who get out. And the result is what Paul calls that we adorn the gospel. It's adorning the gospel with works of goodness. That can't hurt. It ain't going to hurt them. It ain't going to hurt us either. Carrie Wolf and Chris DeVille put together, and a couple of others have put together, a little clip on ideas. And there's going to be a website set up.
There's a website going up. It's supposed to be up. If you go to Xenos website and find under ministries, find the college ministry, there'll be a link to this there. And the last time I looked, it wasn't there yet. So if it's not there yet, it's going to be there in a couple of days. Takes the wheels, turns slow. And they already have a number of ideas here. This is going to be filled out with a calendar and lists of organizations you can hook up with and ideas for your ministry house if you want to try doing, you know, just go out on a Saturday afternoon and do some service, do something for someone else. Great idea, and I appreciate you guys working on this. Well, there's some good ideas for getting started. To next week, then, we'll take up
the even bigger question. Oh, my God, what are we going to do about the rest of the world? And I hope that I hope you haven't had too much. But you'll come back and hear out our ideas on that as well. All right, James 5.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.